And now, from the Green 960 studios in San Francisco, this is an organic conversation with Helga Hellberg.
And welcome to this week's edition of An Organic Conversation, a show about food, relationships, and life itself. I'm your host, Helga Hellberg. I hope you had a fantastic week. Thank you for all your comments that we received. Michaela from Hartford, Connecticut, would like ideas of how to better the food in her local school. Well, there's a lot of angles of where to start, and actually, we did have a show on school lunch programs in May called They Are What They Eat. I believe it was May 9th, which you can find under our show archive at anorganicconversation.com. And also, the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Act will expire and be redefined in September of this year. So this is an important piece of legislation to get involved with. You can Google the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Act. And again, you can also find more information about this on our website at anorganicconversation.com under show archives. If you have a comment or question, please email us at share@anorganicconversation.com. On a recent farm tour in West Marin, I watched a red-tailed hawk mom teach her young one how to nosedive out of about 300 feet in free fall to about 10 feet above the ground, and then swoosh away in a hard upward curve to shoot just over the tree line, barely making it because of the momentum they had, to start the spiral upwards again for the next fake attack. It was amazing. I'd never seen anything like it before. There was nothing to hunt, there was no prey in sight, and the hawks kept doing it over and over again. Ongoing flight maneuvers that were clearly just a lesson in nosediving. And I could hear their bodies zip through the air. They had that much momentum. Mom first, wings tucked, followed 50 feet behind by her juvenile daughter or son. On my way home, the excitement for what I had witnessed melted into an appreciation for nature and then, ultimately, for myself. I pulled the car over and sat there in bliss, realizing how much I loved that I appreciated these crazy hawks so much. For me, the food movement is so rich and inspiring because of all elements. The food justice piece, seeing kids in underserved areas come out to a farm and for them to remember true happiness as they have a direct experience of nature and healthy food right before your eyes. You know, it might not make them food advocates later in life, but I'm sure it will make them advocates for life. Or the glowing face of a farmer at a farmer's market, or the sense of community and service that I feel people are holding and creating. I love the biodiversity in and around an organic farm, the wildlife, the varieties of crops, the scent of the earth. I love fresh, delicious food and knowing where it comes from. But truly, while I know that all these parts, all these individual parts are critically important and deserve our attention and hard work and need to be protected and fostered, ultimately, at the end, I love the organic food movement and what I do, not because I think it's right in terms of right and wrong, but simply because it makes me happy doing it. Because I'm in awe every day by what I'm observing and learning. William Coppersweight, in his book A Handmade Life, says that success in life should be measured by increased happiness. I like that. And I completely believe that out of this happiness, if we as a people live a life full of encouragement and passion, an even healthier world inevitably will follow. You're listening to An Organic Conversation, and we'll be right back after the break.
I've never been the kind that you call love.
And we are back here to an organic conversation. I'm your host, Helge Hellberg. I'm excited about our guest today, a gentleman who talks about the watershed, permaculture design, and our connection to the earth pretty much nonstop, and who is a fierce and yet gentle leader in the sustainable food movement. But first, as always, here's Dan McGovern with the news.
Good morning. This is Sustainable Food News, your weekly news service on an organic conversation, and I'm Dan McGovern. The nation's renegade lunch lady, Chef Ann Cooper, is flying to Capitol Hill to kick off a school lunch revolution and defuse what she says is a public health time bomb. Cooper is being accompanied by Whole Foods Market co-founder Walter Robb, and together will urge lawmakers to support stronger nutritional requirements and better funding for the National School Lunch Program. The 63-year-old program feeds more than 30 million children a year, but lists hamburgers, french fries, chocolate milk, and popsicles as a typical lunch. Every 5 years, a window of opportunity opens on Capitol Hill as lawmakers seek to reauthorize federal child nutrition programs, which expire late next month. Cooper also launched a new website called thelunchbox.org to show schools how to cost-effectively replace frozen processed foods with fresh and more natural and organic foods. The new website is supported in part by a donation from Whole Foods and a donation drive at checkout stands at Whole Foods stores through September. Whole Foods is also sponsoring a video contest for parent-teacher groups, with the winner receiving a visit from Cooper, who calls school lunch nutrition the social justice issue of our time. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has quadrupled the number of grocery stores in its voluntary program designed to reduce the use of ozone-depleting refrigerants. The Green Chill program now includes more than 6,500 stores in 47 states. Last year, program participants cut their aggregate total emissions by 8.5%. EPA officials estimate that if all U.S. supermarkets reduced emissions to the current Green Chill average, the nation could save the equivalent of 22 million metric tons of carbon dioxide, equal to the annual emissions from more than 4 million cars. As National Farmers Market Week wrapped up last weekend, the American Farmland Trust tallied the thousands of votes cast across the country from every state for America's favorite farmers markets. There's close to 4,900 farmers markets operating nationwide this year, up from 4,685 last year. About 860 of them signed up for the competition, which categorized markets by size, determined by the number of vendors. The winners are: Davis Farmers Market in Davis, California was the lead vote getter in the large category. Williamsburg Farmers Market in Williamsburg, Virginia won it for the medium category. And Collingswood Farmers Market in Collingswood, New Jersey led the category for small farmers markets. This is Sustainable Food News, your weekly news service on an organic conversation. I'm Dan McGovern.
Thank you, Dan, for that weekly update. Wow, almost 5,000 farmers market throughout the nation. That's a growing number. And point raised, farmers market didn't win after all.
They didn't. They were, obviously, as you can tell, probably they were in the small category. They came in 10th in that category. So
That's good.
Yeah, they made it in the top 20, you know.
Wow. And
Ferry Plaza actually made it to 12th in the large category. So they weren't too far behind. So some good representation.
Great.
From Bay Area farmers markets.
We have wonderful markets here. And really, you know, with those three winners, congratulations. That's an amazing participation on the people that shop there. But since it's the most direct way of buying from a farmer and the best way of supporting a farm too, I feel that all the markets are winners in this competition. Don't you too?
You bet.
And in regard to school lunch programs, we are featuring that topic again, organic school lunches and the Marin Organic School Lunch Program, on September 12th in about 4 weeks. So thanks again, Dan McGovern, Sustainable Food News, for this wonderful weekly service.
Thank you, Helga.
My guest today is the wildlife biologist, and he's the co-director of the Arts and Ecology Center in Occidental near Sebastopol in Northern California. Welcome, Brock Dolman. Welcome, Brock.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for being here. How are you?
I'm good. It's a beautiful day out there. A little bit of fog, a little bit of sun. Typical Bay Area weather.
Yeah, thanks for coming down. I know you had to break out of a workshop that's going on right now at the Arts and Ecology Center.
Yeah.
What are you teaching right now?
It's one of these 2-week-long permaculture design courses where students come for 2 weeks. It's a residential course at the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center. And we basically unpack. It's a ecological literacy training, in essence, for a regenerative and sustainable vision of how to rebuild the future world at urban, suburban, rural scales.
So what are some of the components really hands on that our listeners get a picture of what is being taught?
Well, the basic themes, it's a design course, so a lot of it is about sustainable design and how to think about design, and then we'll deal with things such as water systems, water supply, wastewater, organic farming, food foresting, rotational grazing, natural building, alternative currencies, community development, intentional community, co-housing. So there's lecture to that. We do a whole bunch of hands-on projects where students actually learn kinesthetically by doing, and they also have group design work where they actually do designs and present those to the group.
So you're building a straw bale house or something, or the basic outline of that, like something like that?
We'll talk a lot about straw bale or cob or rammed earth and those materials and what's their embedded energy, where do they come from, how are they regenerative or can be, how are they used in a building for insulation or thermal mass or indoor air quality improvements or these kinds of things. And green building and natural building are two arenas. So in the housing piece, that would be the kind of stuff we're talking about, in some cases having hands-on projects installing those.
Can you explain the term regenerative? What does it mean when it comes to materials?
Well, if we're looking at materials and they have a concept of the embodied energy or the life cycle analysis of a material, is there a way to have a practice, say a farming practice, that doesn't just take from the land and even caretaking, but is caregiving? Can we give back? And through the process of the management of the land, could we increase the water holding capacity of the land? Could we increase the carbon? Could we improve wildlife habitat through the planting strategies so that we have better red-tailed hawk nesting habitat for those beautiful red-tailed hawks that you witness, while having a productive yield there that maybe functions also as a windbreak and also helps microclimate and reduces the edge of frost and is also a native plant? And so we get into things we call stacking functions and multiple benefits of elements in a design, and we build relational systems that compose with the living world versus impose upon them.
And so when you talk about life cycle analysis in terms of buying something at a store, you would ask, how's it made? Where was it made? Where will the packaging go? Where will the product go when it's over, when it's broken? Are those
exactly
the basic?
Yeah, you look at that whole source to sink.
Right.
How much energy did it take to extract it, produce it, manufacture it, ship it, you use it, and then what's the away part? And the notion of away is one of the great fallacies, right? There is no away on finite planet Earth, and we have to really figure that out. I don't know if anyone's been away lately, if you have to get a visa to go away, but the dead zones in the ocean or the big trash gyres out in the Pacific don't go away.
Yes, they might be out of sight for a moment, but not really.
Exactly. So yeah. I think the local food movements are classic. You can either buy pre-processed packaged food, or you can have seasonal food that's local, organic, and wild, which is what we call the true slow food movement. Seasonal, local, organic, wild, it's slow food.
And so you were touching on my intro, just on a side note. Have you ever witnessed anything like it? Because it sounded almost, I've never seen a training facility for birds or for animals. Yeah, I've never seen them practice something that they would then do later. That seems beyond instinct. That was a really interesting observation.
As a wildlife biologist, and professionally I worked as an ornithologist for many years studying birds and raptors specifically and such. There's the notion of the nature nurture discussion, and I think that just mixes up that we have both of those things, and so many traits are genetic or intrinsic, and many things need to be taught, and how to hunt and how to manage your muscles and your just the exercising of that baby bird to be able to hold those G-forces as it comes careening down and swoops has to be, it's like athletics. You have to get yourself in shape.
Yes, and I remember watching, you know, bears, polar bears, and they follow their mom, but in the real attempt to hunt. This was not a real attempt to hunt. I would say that the juvenile bird knew that this is just training practice.
Yeah. And I think and a lot, you see just the sense of play in many species. We think it's playfulness when you watch wolves or you watch hawks, but that's all part of building skills and developing muscles and
social
neural
skills.
Stuff. And yeah. So, and a later, if you get to watch it, you'll watch sometimes they'll They'll trade prey in the air as they get better. The adult will catch a snake and it'll come up and it'll fly upside down and the baby will take it from the talons and transfer it and they'll start learning how to eat the prey or hold it and the adults will, and if they drop the snake, the adult will whip down and pick it up midair. I've seen it and bring it back and teach them again, fly up higher. And it's pretty neat stuff.
Yeah, by swooshing up from that G-force, I actually thought my eyes were tricking me, but I think the mom was going over the tree line, coming back up with such amazing speed. I mean, it was really a black dot zipping through air, right? Actually upside down. Have you seen that?
Absolutely really? Possible. And you can watch ravens do that a lot. They barrel roll and fly upside down and goof off. They're the king tricksters, play in the air for sure.
So you talk a lot about watershed. What's important about what is a watershed and why is it important for us?
Yeah, it's a really interesting idea. So basically, if people were to cup your hands and hold them out in front of you, and like you were going to be taking a drink from a stream or something, that creates a cradle or creates a shape of a basin. And all of the land through time and erosion of water and geology and uplift and such have carved out landscapes, the topography of the landscape, where there's higher areas, the ridges, and water flows over and eventually goes down to a river, eventually to the ocean. And there's little tributaries and things that kind of looks like when you look at a leaf, how there's the main vein and the smaller veins out to the rim of the leaf. And these areas, these containers then are known as watersheds or basins or drainages, depending on their size. And the interesting thing about them is they're containers that are created by time and place with water, geology, processes, life. They're not human-imposed situations like a county or a city boundary or something like that. And everyone on the planet lives in one. And from the ridgeline to the river mouth out to the reef is a container. And I think of them as living lifeboats, and we're going to have to, community by community, watershed by watershed, learn how to manage our land use and our water use in such a way to maintain the integrity or regenerative capacity of these living lifeboats, because that the lifeboats we're going to need in this uncertain, changing future of what some are now calling global weirding.
What do they exactly provide?
Yeah, your watershed is imagine the rain coming down throughout the system, the water supply, both the water quality needs to be managed, the water quantity, the surface water, the groundwater supply, how the soils are created, the relationship to erosion or not, obviously very important to agriculture or forestry or ranching, how urbanization is settled in a landscape in relationship to floodplains and those edges, and how do we manage pollution or not. Transportation. So every human land use behavior occurs within a watershed, and we have to figure out how to retrofit human land uses so that they are hydrologically literate in a way within the basin of relation, the watershed, the basin that you live in, all the relations you share with it, so that we can have intergenerational integrity in place through time. And if you look at many behaviors now, with topsoil erosion and polluted rivers and cancer alleys and dead zones and deforestation and collapsing economic communities because the primary resources have been extracted at a rate greater than their replenishment, it's an opportunity to have a geographic container upon which you can think about the idea of sustainability, but it's actually localized.
So the Arts and Ecology Center, is that the main goal? Is that the main mission? What's your mission?
Yeah.
What can be communicated to create direct change?
Yeah. So we have the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center is a 501c3 nonprofit. And actually it was in 1994, there were seven of us who bought this piece of land together in Sonoma County. And we actually live there a bunch
several
of
acres, right?
It's 80 acre parcel, and it's owned by an intentional community called Sewing Circle. There's currently 10 of us that live there. So it's a consensus based collective. And then we have the nonprofit, which operates as a worker collective. And it's primary mission is to be a land-based demonstration center that also provides a educational institute to bring people to the place and teach them the skills or work with them. And then also we have programs off-site that we go out into communities, such as a basins of relations training that I do for community-based watershed organizing, or we have a school garden teacher training program in public schools throughout the Bay Area.
So who's coming? Kids and teachers and...
In the case of the school garden teacher training program, it's public school teachers. We have a half-time staff in San Francisco that does only low-income schools, and the teachers come for a week and we get into school garden teacher training so that they'll learn how to grow food, towards that earlier question that the email from the last show. In the watershed issue, it's local landowners, farmers, urban folks, suburban folks interested in endangered salmonids, their own water supply, security, wastewater, stormwater, agricultural integrity. We have the permaculture design program, where we're really looking at how do we do sustainable design, sustainable building, sustainable economy within the context of sustainable ecology. So it depends on the course. We have a wood shop for women course where women come and learn about basic tools and how to do basic carpentry stuff, or we'll have a training on wildland restoration and native plants and native seed collecting, or we have arts programs, we have a theater program. So we cater to a whole diverse array of constituencies, depending on the subject area. And some of those courses are land-based on the center at OAC, and some are, we go off to the people offsite.
And so teaching women wood skills, what's your intention? Like what's at the heart of it all?
I think at the heart of it all, it's personal empowerment for individuals. In that case, a woman wanting to feel empowered, to be able to know how to use a power tool in a safe way, or a hammer or a screwdriver or a table saw, to ultimately be able to build something, whatever she, in this case, creatively wants to construct and sculpt and bring forward in this life, and feel confident in doing that. Because in many respects in our society, for what it's worth, in this day and age, women aren't often taken into the shop and shown how to safely use a table saw or a jigsaw or a screwdriver or a hammer. And so that's that. In that instance, it's very much personal empowerment to allow those folks to just be better able to realize what they wish to do.
Which this might be at the heart of sustainability, right? Personal empowerment, that we manifest as the beautiful beings that we actually are. Speaking with Brock Dolman of the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center, and you just returned from a trip from far away, and we'll talk about that in a minute right after the break.
Organic Conversation is brought to you by Svatica Skincare. Founded by Janet Lee Katzen, Svatica is a holistic approach to skincare that is 100% pure and natural, free of synthetic chemicals, and includes organic and wild-crafted ingredients. For more information about Svatica Skincare products and the Svatica Spa, visit svatica.com. That's Svatika.com.
Hi, I'm Peter Walsh. My wife and I founded Manika Jewelry with the intention to offer a different kind of jewelry. Beautiful, made by local Bay Area artists, and without a social or environmental compromise. Our featured designers use reclaimed precious metals and Kimberly certified gemstones. It's jewelry made with heart and soul. Come visit our store just off Union Square at 11 Maiden Lane in San Francisco, or visit our website at manikajewelry.com.
For the ultimate West Marin experience, visit Toby's Feed Barn in Point Reyes Station, home of the Point Reyes Farmers Market every Saturday. Toby's Feed Barn features organic produce, native plants, gifts, books, an organic coffee bar, an art gallery, concerts, even daily yoga classes. Toby's Feed Barn in downtown Point Reyes Station, open 7 days a week, family owned and operated since 1942, a West Marin original. For more information, visit tobysfeedbarn.com.
Fry Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Fry never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Fry organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Fry Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines, without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at frywine.com. That's F-R-E-Y-W-I-N-E.
Marin Organic is an association of organic producers in Marin County, California, which has become one of the most progressive voices in the sustainable food movement in the United States. Through its many innovative initiatives, such as a school lunch and gleaning program, Marin Organic is creating a healthy, sustainable, and safe environment for all beings, today and for generations to come. Please become a partner in our work by visiting marinorganic.org and by pledging your support now. Thank you.
And we are back to an organic conversation here on Green 960. I'm Helge Hellberg, and my guest today is Brock Dolman, wildlife biologist and co-director of the Arts and Ecology Center in Occidental near Sebastopol in Northern California. Brock, we were just talking about women and power tools and that the ecological movement and the sustainable movement is about empowering the individual in all aspects, our relationship to nature. What are you observing in nature? What have you learned in nature that you show now to the people that come to OAEC?
It's a great question. I mean, being a biologist by definition is one who studies life. And so since I came out the womb kicking and screaming, I've been hard pressed to be kept out of wet, mucky, stinky, slimy places chasing snakes and frogs. And you know, it's a good thing I'm immune to poison oak so far, so good. And nature has been the greatest babysitter and the greatest teacher and the greatest mentor and in good ways and, you know, sometimes hard-won lessons, right?
Like what?
Oh, you know, I've had run-ins with lots of yellow jacket nests and tarantulas and, you know, scorpions and all kinds of wonderful venomous creatures, but builds character, as they say. I think for me that the thing is this, there's this frame out there these days called nature deficit disorder, and Richard Louv has written a lot about this and popularized it in his book Last Child in the Woods, and
of lack of eco-literacy.
Exactly. This ecological literacy is a mouthful of a word, but the notion of ecology itself is a mouthful, and literacy, and I think in this society, read and write and arithmetic is something that we pride ourselves on one way or another. But can you read the landscape? Is the landscape's an open book, and if you're literate, you can walk on a landscape and you can read the time and passage, and you could talk about geology or fire or trees and succession or wildlife habitat and read into these things and understand them. And so
we know how to use our cell phones, but we would not survive 2 days in the wild, basically, right? Because we don't know what to eat. We don't know what is poisonous.
On average, I would venture to guess that's probably the dominant skill set of a modern, quote, American at this point and many other people. So nature is something that it's not to be dominated over, but it's, and there are times where we may be perceiving ourselves competing with it. But I think cooperation is at the hallmark of the presence of life on this planet, symbiosis. And life creates conditions conducive for more life. That's what we've observed in the last 3 billion years. And as a conservation biologist, I firmly am a believer in cooperative spirit. And how do we then as people figure out how to cooperate with the fact that there's a whole bunch of life going on out there, and there's other kingdoms of organisms that we should work with, the fungus, the bacteria, the plants, the other microscopic critters. How do we play with them in a good way versus fight against them? So we teach a lot about in these movements where it's a probiotic process. I would argue it's the ultimate pro-life movement here, life of all forms on this planet, of living planet here, instead of antibiotic, where we're against life and we're just trying to distill it down to a single plant and have sterile soils in an industrial agricultural model. So how do we get people reconnected and then engaged and then re-involved with being supporters of helping to craft conditions conducive for life, so life will do the work that we want it to do: grow food, clean water, compost materials, convert leaves into good organic fertilizer, or worms, and this kind of stuff.
And there's a certain playfulness in nature that we often are not aware of. Where there's death and there's killing, and life feeds off each other, and we need death in order to create new life. But you were just talking about during the break about the peregrine falcon who does what? He hunts birds in midair.
The trademark of the peregrine falcons are other, they eat other birds, and they're famous for probably being the fastest animal on the planet. And they can upward speeds of 180, 200 miles an hour in a, what they call a stoop, where they're diving straight down before they hit another bird. And then just what you observed with the red-tailed hawks and training babies, there's all kinds of courtship rituals or training rituals for juveniles. And many times they will catch a bird, and once it's dead, they'll drop it in midair and let the baby try to catch it in midair as if it was going to hunt it. And if it misses, then it can just dive down and get it. And other behaviors where they're training and things. I think we underestimate the value that other animals have multi-generational knowledge within their population and that they train. For instance, beavers, everyone thinks about beavers, they think about building dams. Well, dam building in beavers is a learned trait taught, passed down through the generations by the parents. And if a baby beaver's never taught how to build dams, it just burrows into the hillside and makes a hole in the mud. It's a learned trait. And muskox are the same thing. And many animals are like that. And so
muskox
are if you get the migration route and where the food is and where the place when it's really windy, where can you find the shallow grass without the snow covering it to eat, and where do you go in the spring to have your babies, those routes are learned and passed on, and that's knowledge that the population has to have. And if you hunt out the elders in the muskox population, this is information that the folks in Canada learned when they were allowing hunting of the big old ones, very similar things if you study elephants and whales and big animals, that there's a lot more community connection and relationship and teaching and wisdom transfer by elders within animal populations than we tend to give them credit for.
So how do you see that, take that, translate it, and communicate it to your clients, to the people, to the kids, and to older people and teachers and everyone who comes to the Arts and Ecology Center, or is pointing it out and having them see it and understand it enough?
I think that we're often trying different levels of that. So there are times where just taking a walk and pointing out ideas and sparking people's imagination gives them the chance to reflect on it themselves. And then sometimes the pedagogy, if you will, is very didactic, and it's very structural in pointing out in physical relationships for people. And I think those learning styles, those learning modalities, those multiple intelligences, if you will, different folks have different learning styles, and some folks are kinesthetic learners. They just need to go learn by doing. And so we'll go out in the woods and we'll limb up a tree and thin out a forest to reduce the fuel load and use that brush to put in a gully, a head cut where erosion's happening to stop the erosion to keep the water clean for the salmon. And that sounds very intellectual, but if you just get out in the woods for 2 hours with some loppers and a saw and some gloves and build it and do it. And so we're trying to balance theory and pragmatic hands-on learning with folks, and in the process actually do good work on the property that we've inherited that needs a lot of good work done on it.
And truly it's a remembering, right? I mean, even us as humans in this case, if we've never done it in this lifetime, and maybe we have not been shown until, you know, you or your staff at OAEC does the training, or any other permaculture center in the US. But have you seen that actually there's a remembering that kicks in? Because we have done it for tens of thousands of years, and only in the last two generations, basically, we have lost that direct connection, maybe since 1900, to nature. Before that, you know, with the invention of the plow and larger areas of land, and then fertilizers, and then synthetic fertilizers later, that was kind of the turning away from the land. So up until the mid 1800s. So do you see when you teach people that they actually, in a way, remember?
There are some behaviors that when people do them, afterwards they'll say, God, that felt so natural or so right. And they've never gone out in the field and hand collected native grass seed, but all of our elders say, European elders or California Native American elders were grass seed collectors of the original barley, the original wheat, or the native bunch grasses of California. We do use very cautiously, very intentionally with prescriptions, fire at times as a land healing regenerative tool for our coastal grasslands and prairies. And that's an ecological emulation of disturbances that were used by native people for a long time. And
healing, and what does it do? What would fire do?
Yeah, well, in certain situations with grasslands, there's a nutrient cycling process, there's a thatch conversion process, overgrown grasslands that have been undergrazed in some instances. There's different, scalping, if you will, of the grasses down so that you get rid of the old and make room for new regeneration of plants, bunch grasses. It's a mimicry of, in many cases, flooding or grazing or bivory from large animals. Does similar things, but fire does different types of
disturbance. And you need the ashes, regimes. And it's fertilizer in a way, and fires have happened, you know, for millions of years, of course.
Exactly.
I know that there's a certain tree, is it the redwood tree, that actually needs fire in order to germinate?
Many of them do. Many of what are called the closed cone pines, like knob cone pine and Monterey pine, are technically called serotonous pines, and the cone really needs that heat to break open, and those seeds land in that new alkaline ash bed, and that's the perfect seed bed for them to sprout in, and they tend to be shorter lived pines. Redwood has its own relationship to fire, but for me there was a deep intrinsic feeling when we were using fire in a good way, in a healing way that was in control in the morning, it was cool, it was moist, that felt as old as I can, my little reptilian hindbrain could ever remember. And it was a deep-seated experience. Making fire with a couple sticks, rubbing them together in an old way, which we teach or have people teach those classes. So there is that, what often is called Tending the Wild, which is the title of an amazing book by M. Cat Anderson. She would be a wonderful guest here. And so I think ecological illiteracy is the gravest epidemic we face on the planet today. And so anything we can do, if we are wishing to restore ecosystems, for me, the work of the day then as an educator, as someone who's practicing these things, is really not to get to ecosystem restoration. We have to begin with ecosystem restoration. How do we restore the ecosystem? What's the story you believe in your ecosystem? And how do we get people together in a social way to behave in a regenerative manner for the ecological system upon which our ecosystem is actually dependent upon?
Which is fascinating, that really almost every challenge that we face as a society is man-made. And but that also means that we are the ones who can accept that and change it. We are the ones who can actually change the course and learn from nature and act accordingly. And just in terms of fire suppression, coming back to that, I know that in certain national parks, the main goal was fire suppression, and there was no new growth of trees because, as you said, they needed the fire in order to germinate, and we didn't know that on that level or didn't use it as a technique or a tool.
Yeah. Fire suppression is a very recent newcomer to the North American continent for the most part. And when you look historically, many native peoples in many parts of America used fire, not in all ecosystems and at all time and at different intensities, but fire was a useful tool. And so a subset of ecological illiteracy, what I would call is pyro illiteracy and fire illiteracy. And California, not every vegetation community, but the vast majority of our communities, our oak woodlands, our hardwood systems, our conifers, our grasslands, our chaparrals, have a fire dependency to them where there's some fire return interval, and it depends on the community, that heals and moves energy. And there were historical lightning strike systems, and then native people learned how to use fire as an agricultural tool, in essence, kind of a plow-like device, if you will, for preparation and cultivation and insect control under oaks to kill the oak moth larvae that were in the acorns and amazing stuff. But in this day and age, it's a dangerous force because we've suppressed it so much.
And there's so much dry,
so much,
old brush on
exactly, the buildup of fire. And
when it burns, it's just way more intense.
And everybody's houses are stuck in the middle of the forest, and you can't really use fire in the same way because we're living in the what they call the wildland urban interface.
Speaking to Brock Dolman, wildlife biologist and co-director of the Arts and Ecology Center in Occidental. And I do want to get to your trip that you just returned from China and what you saw there. But we'll be right back after another quick break.
Johnny wanna be a big star, get on stage and play the guitar, make a little money by a fancy car, a big old house and an alligator, just to match with them alligator shoes. He's a rich man, so he's no longer singing the blues. He's singing songs about material things and platinum rings and watches that go bling. But diamonds don't blink in the dark. He a star now, but he ain't singing it from the heart. Sooner or later, it's just gonna fall apart, cause his fans can't relate to his newfound art. He ain't doing what he did from the start, and that's putting in some feeling and thought. He decided to live his life shallow, cash in his love from a...
An Organic Conversation is brought to you by Svatika Skincare. Founded by Janet Lee Katzen, Svatika is a holistic approach to skincare that is 100% pure and natural, free of synthetic chemicals, and includes organic and wild-crafted ingredients. For more information about Svatika skincare products and the Svatika Spa, visit svatika.com. That's Svatika.com.
Marin Organic is an association of organic producers in Marin County, California, which has become one of the most progressive voices in the sustainable food movement in the United States. Through its many innovative initiatives, such as a school lunch and gleaning program, Marin Organic is creating a healthy, sustainable, and safe environment for all beings, today and for generations to come. Please become a partner in our work by visiting marinorganic.org and by pledging your support now. Thank you.
Fry Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Fry never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Fry organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Fry Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines, without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at frywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Are you looking for a romantic and unusual location in the Bay Area for your wedding or upcoming anniversary? Toby's Feed Barn offers the perfect venue for your celebration. A rustic barn in the heart of beautiful West Marin, with local organic caterers ready to delight your guests amid bales of hay. Toby's Feed Barn in downtown Point Reyes Station. Open 7 days a week. Family owned and operated since 1942. A West Marin original. For more information, visit tobysfeedbarn.com.
Sustainable Food News is the premier source of daily news and market information for the organic, sustainable, and natural food industries. Headline after headline, Sustainable Food News reports on a profound shift in food buying habits as more and more people begin to understand the impact of their purchases on the environment and communities around the world. Join Dan McGovern, publisher of Sustainable Food News, every Saturday morning on An Organic Conversation. For more information, visit www.sustainablefoodnews.com.
And we are back to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg, and today I'm speaking with Brock Dolman of the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center. Brock, you just returned from a trip to Eastern Tibet and China.
Yeah.
What did you do there?
Yeah, I was invited to go with a woman named Betsy Damon, who has an organization called Keepers of the Waters. And we were in the province of Sichuan, which is amazing food, where Sichuan Chinese food, which I got to taste a lot of. And the primary agenda of the trip was to go out of the city of Chengdu up into what is basically the foothills of the Himalaya in the eastern portion of the Tibetan plateau and work with traditional Tibetan cultural people and villages and research and have a witness, if you will, of their relationship to water and specifically sources of water, the headwaters, the springs. How do they manage those? What's their cultural, religious, spiritual stories about them?
It's the center of several major rivers, right?
The Tibetan Plateau itself. We were in the Yangtze Basin, but just north of us would be the Yellow River Basin, and just south is the Mekong, and not far from that is the Brahmaputra, and then you've got the Ganges and the Irrawaddy and the Indus, and so many of the big rivers of the world are all coming off of originating as glacier-fed systems in the high peaks of the Himalaya, and then dropping down in that arc around there, you know, in the various countries. And so we were on that eastern flank feeding, in this case, the Yangtze Basin as the watersheds and the sub-watersheds we were in.
And the goal was to document water quality issues, or...
It was more of a cultural relationship story about the Tibetan peoples and their context and relationship to water in a spiritual sense. And in this area, the Tibetans are Buddhists. And so we were visiting a lot of monasteries. We were visiting many sacred springs and sources of water and limestone caves where water comes out and these places, and trying to find a reverential relationship with water that still has some integrity to it. And there are many places on the planet where this still exists, but Betsy was very specifically interested for this part of the process in folks in this part of Tibet.
And what have you found?
What I found is that I've never seen so many prayer flags in my life, for sure. I mean, these folks are deeply spiritual, reverential people.
That's,
and have a
so
connection.
Beautiful.
And that Buddhist philosophy is very polytheistic and many deities.
And
folks have been passing it down for generations. And so we visited many beautiful areas and saw many water shrines and heard stories and miraculous tales of water coming and back, and one area where during the Cultural Revolution in the 60s the whole watershed was clear cut, and then the monastery was destroyed, and then sometime in the late 70s early 80s they reoccupied this monastery to rebuild it, the Tibetan folks after the Han Chinese, and began reforesting the hillside themselves just out of their own sense of spiritual duty. And interestingly enough, this famous spring that had been there for many hundreds of years before, which is why the monastery was even located there, had dried up during the clear-cut phase, and not long after, a decade or so after the reforestation efforts, the spring began to flow again, and the fresh, clear waters from the spring began to come back to life again.
Why? What's the interrelationship? What do trees do?
Yeah, trees are interesting. They use water, and they're also water producers, if you will. Trees can change the... what's called the albedo, or the reflectivity of an area. They can lower the temperature. They evapotranspire water and can rehumidify areas at different scales. When water does come down, if you've got a good canopy, it slows the water, spreads the water. The humus and the leaf litter can help it sink. So you get a slow it, spread it, sink it type of system. Get increased groundwater recharge and reduced runoff and less sedimentation in the rivers. And so if that's happening above an area with certain geology that you can infiltrate shallow groundwater, then it will come out as a spring. And so forests are rain makers and precipitation makers and water cleaners and water cleansers. And deforestation has led to desertification everywhere we've practiced it for the last five millennia on the planet. And you can read lots of books about Incans in Easter Island and the Mediterranean and North Africa and such. And so, you know, water, I think, for me, has, again, as a biologist and studying life, what I really became clear on is that this little Mickey Mouse molecule of H2O is, by volume, every living being on the planet is mostly water. We're carbon-based life forms, but we're mostly water. Water is really the lubricant of life in our tissues and our flesh and our capacity to digest or excrete waste or move oxygenated blood or not, or pass neural synaptic messages from, you know, our brain to our fingertips. And when you're dehydrated, many of those things break down. And so many Americans, it's roughly, I think, 60-70% of Americans are chronically dehydrated, and there's many thoughts on epidemiology and disease issues that may stem from dehydration. So I would toast all of you out there to stay hydrated and drink a good glass of fresh water, hopefully from your tap in your local municipal supply and not corporate bottled water.
All life, you said, is mostly water. Humans are, what, 80%?
Depending on how old you are. When you're a baby, by volume, you're mostly water. You might be up in that 80 percentile ratio. And as you, the older you get, the less by volume water you are. And so, in fact, dehydration is the leading driver of death, if you will. And you just, as you age, you dry out and get wrinkly. So again, you got to stay hydrated. It's the fountain of youth. As with people, dehydration, for me, my watershed moment, if you will, as a wildlife biologist studying endangered species, was when I found land uses in watersheds that dehydrated the watershed and degraded the water quality, then the carrying capacity for life in that place, whether it was the frog I was looking for, the snake, or the human community, would commensurately be reduced and reduced. And so I've mostly then really tried to understand land uses that facilitate rehydration and of water. How do we slow it and spread it and sink it versus our pave it, pipe it, pollute it mode, which is much of what we've been doing.
Or straight into the ocean where it gets salted in a heartbeat and is not used before.
Exactly.
So back to Tibet for a sec. What's the impact of global warming? I know that those glaciers are drastically shrinking, which has an effect on all those as a headwater on all those rivers that you mentioned. What have you seen in that regard, and how do the Tibetans, who have a great reverence for water, how do they deal with that?
Well, it was something I was really interested in because, again, you know, all of those great seven or eight rivers there are all ultimately initially glacier fed, and all of the data is showing that just not in the Himalaya, but every glacier on the planet almost, there's a few exceptions, interestingly, are in some state of recession, of shrinkage, of melting away. And we know about Arctic and Arctic ice. And so we went to several high mountain areas where there's 20,000 or 22,000 foot peaks that have glaciers on the top. And we would ask the locals, is there more or less of that ice up there? And in every case, they all would say there was less. And in a couple cases, we actually saw photos from the 1920s and the 1980s. And then we were looking now in 2009, and we were able to compare and look at the mountain, and there was significant loss of ice pack held as a glacier, which is very critical with respect to storage of water and the release and the timing of the release of water and how that impacts late season flows in rivers for irrigation or groundwater recharge, or does it all run off as liquid and increase flooding and such. And if you've got 3 billion plus people rapidly growing in China and India and those areas, and the forecast is that in 50 years, 75 years, seems very likely, but at 100 years, that many of the majority of the glacial area covering the Himalaya will be gone.
Tibetans know that, and how do they react to that?
I don't know how many of them can astutely unpack the inconvenient truth shtick, if you will, but they recognize that something's not good, that the glaciers are going away, and the implication of that on how they've become accustomed to managing their life and how they move water in ditches just off contour to irrigate their barley fields up high. And so they're grappling with it as the farmers are on Mount Kilimanjaro, as the farmers are in the high Peruvian Andes. It's again, these crises of climate change are impacting disproportionately in many cases these folks who never ascended peak oil, if you will. They've been living like they have been traditionally forever, and they're going to be some of the first hit and hardest hit by the behavior of us industrial emissions who have affluenza, if you will.
And we're talking in that particular case that there are entire countries, Cambodia and other countries, who depend on that head watershed, which is now controlled by China.
That case, China controls the headwaters of many of those rivers subsequent to their taking of the Tibetan Plateau 50 years ago. So they're actively planning and currently damming up many parts of the Yangtze and the Mekong and parts of what will be the Brahmaputra, and those downstream countries are not at the table of decision making in that situation, and it's disconcerting to them, to say the least.
So you, as a wildlife biologist, were attracted to studying life and water and wildlife by a fascination for it, by a fascination of the beauty and the potential it holds and the lesson it holds. And you were saying before the show that, yes, of course, I would rather see rivers full of salmon, which we, for example, in Marin County, or where you are at in Occidental Sebastopol, that area, just a few decades ago, there were rivers packed with salmon. And we are now, looking at a few dozen at best, if any. How do you care for your own personal sustainability? What do you do by being at the heart of the problem, seeing it, and yet teaching people about the beauty of it in the face of this destruction? How do you deal with your own sustainability?
It's a great question. I try to take a lot of walks, and I try to go to beautiful places and get just physically restored and re-inspired and witness, you know, wonderful feats of nature or beautiful landscapes and such. But I think time and time again, I've just come back to there's more fulfillment in the face of these changes to participate in some attempt to alter them, change them, adapt to them, restore function of systems than being so depressed by it that we just check out and not do anything at all. And so that kind of that proactive, if things are happening that way, I'd rather get in the middle of the fight and see if we can tweak the direction. Or in some cases, we, you know, have some significant success on that.
Where is that coming from? Have you always had that? Or where's that voice? Why? I mean, I agree with you. And yes, that's, but what's your motivation of doing it?
Yeah, you know, brock is an old English word for badger. And so I guess, and my parents didn't really know that much, but I kind of have that badgerly spirit, and I'll just dig in on a fight and just, you know, if it's the right fight and it's a good fight and it's a fight for life, really, like all of life. I'm, you know, again, as a biologist, I'm highly biocentric, not anthropocentric per se, but and it's just the fun part about it is that participating in the organic food movement, or what I call the slow water movement, right? The slow it, spread it, sink it watershed, or the salmon restoration, or the natural building movement, or the community, intentional community movement, is the people are just really cool, and you get to meet amazing people. You get to have a great food, and we have great organic wine, and our parties are more fun, and the sensual relationship of connecting in these very positive and proactive and engaged movements is that the no regrets policy says it's a lot more fun to do it. And if none of the global climate change stuff was to happen, I'd still rather live in a natural building that's solar powered and off grid or integrated with my rainwater harvesting, gray water organic system, than the other alternatives. So it's just more fun and more engaging. And so sustainable hedonism, if you will, is one of the drivers of doing the work, just because it's a more engaged and better life.
Right. Back to my intro. We just simply love what we're doing.
Right. And so I really love and honor and don't take for granted the blessing of the fact that I get to live and work in a place and do the kind of work that feeds me, and that I have no other choice to do anyway, because I'm just completely passionate about doing that work. And thank goodness we have the capacity to do that and make a life out of it.
Brock the Badger Dulman, co-director of OAEC, and the website, I believe, of the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center is oaec.org. If you want to find out more, upcoming classes, what is being taught. Thank you so much, Brock, for coming to the studio on this beautiful day, foggy and sunny, for sharing your story and all your knowledge. We could speak for a weekend. Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Yeah.
An Organic Conversation is produced by Hardy Hartley. Sound engineer is Jen Lloyd. Production assistant, Kristen O'Heary. Underwriting production provided by Mark Van Gelder. Thank you all. And also always thanks to the team here at Green 960, Mark McNone, John Scott, and John Plessis. And of course, thank you, our listeners, for being part of this show and for actually listening. For blogs, podcasts, and more information on this show and previous shows, please visit our website at anorganicconversation.com. And you can also find us now on iTunes, where you can download An Organic Conversation to your iPod and take us with you on the road. We love to hear from you. Please send us your comments and questions to share at anorganicconversation.com. Coming up next is the Gavin Newsom Show, so please stay put. I'm your host, Helge Hellberg. Have a great weekend, and thanks again for listening to An Organic Conversation here on Green 960. Never cost a thing. And the pain you feel's a different kind of pain.